It is just 12 o'clock, and you are 12 noon, that is, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio 102.7, listener-sponsored radio in Western Canada. And, of course, we are heard around the world on cooperadio.org. And now, it's time for Animal Voices.
Afternoon, and welcome to Animal Voices, the show that puts the horse before the cart. My name is John Pranger.
I'm Carl Luskin.
And I'm Marge Adams.
And we've got a full show for you today, so let's get right on it. Man has always had a fascination with the birds and the bees, and traditionally linked to production and food. Now the fascination is turning to concern, if not horror. Why? Because the birds and the bees are disappearing. Over the winter of 2006-07, bee populations have plummeted in what is being referred to as colony collapse disorder. And we're going to be talking today with Milk Bowling of clearenergycanada.com about colony collapse disorder and the increasing skyrocketing rate of cell phone transmission pollution. And is this really the cause of what is going on with the birds and the bees? After that, we're going to be talking to Brian Klinkenberg, who is professor of geography at UBC and the coordinator of the eFauna website, which has just been launched at efauna.bc.ca. And it's a nonprofit partnership project aimed at providing a free and comprehensive electronic atlas of the wildlife of British Columbia. And when it's completed, eFauna BC will provide the detailed information on all known wildlife species in British Columbia, including bats, birds, beetles, bugs, and more. And for the third section of our show, we're going to be talking to Gaia Gardens Herbal Dispensary Clinic, Robert McCandles, who is an employee there. I think he's a herbalist. And it's about Health Canada being set to dismantle the natural health product industry. It's an urgent message that he's going to be bringing us to all of us who use natural health products such as vitamins and supplements, because our future access to many of these products is in danger of being severely curtailed and possibly eliminated within the next 2 years. While this sounds unbelievable, unfortunately, it is all too true. Health Canada is proposing to implement manufacturers' fees that will result in skyrocketing retail prices and perhaps put a lot of manufacturers and store owners out of business and restrict our rights to a cheap supply of these products. So we'll be right back with our first guest, Milk Bowling, and stay tuned.
Is the president of Clean Energy Foundation based here in Vancouver, and he is a senior associate of the Save Wireless Initiative. So he has been on Co-op Radio a number of times, a very valued guest. Welcome to Animal Voices, Milt Bowling.
Thanks very much.
Well, you know, of course, there's been so much in the news lately about the bees, and John read the editorial, but which leads one to ask, How dependent is the human race on the outright disappearance of bees?
Well, if bees disappear, so will we eventually. I mean, they pollinate so many of the food crops. I believe it's in the neighborhood of 80% of the food crops that need pollination are pollinated by bees. So if they disappear, we're in big trouble. And they're really an indicator. It's like the canary in the coal mine. You know, what is happening to the bees? You don't think it'll happen to us?
Well, maybe you can just enumerate what is actually happening and talk about colony collapse disorder, CCD.
Right, Carl. Colony collapse disorder has been a recent phenomenon where there's been a massive and sudden decline in bee colonies really throughout the world. And it's... I guess the unique features of it is that there are no dead bodies. You know, you can't get CSI or whatever to investigate this. There are no dead bodies in the hives. What happens is the bees leave the hives, fully intending to return, and never find their way back there. So there's no dead bees in the hives. They've left the queen and the capped brood in the hive. Now, when bees leave the hive, if they're fully intended to swarm and go somewhere, I mean, the queen's the first one they take with them. So it's totally abnormal behavior for bees, and there's all kinds of theories about, why it is a problem. And most of those don't really hold water when you analyze them. It's a worldwide epidemic, and if you look at it like an epidemic, it spread instantly globally, and a lot of the factors that they're considering, like mites and pesticides and genetically modified foods, aren't globally distributed.
Right. So now it's been said that the way the bees find their way back to the hive, as you explained, they're going out there but not finding their way back because we're not finding the dead bees in the hives. So they're not finding their way back to the hives, and which suggests that they might have some kind of internal compass. How do you think they find their way back?
Well, they have magnetite in their abdomen, and they align with the sun and with the Earth's electromagnetic field to find their way back to the hives. Now, what we're suggesting is that electromagnetic fields are interrupting their communication and their navigation systems. And people say, well, you know, how does that happen? Well, the cell towers and other wireless transmitters around the world, cell phones have been around for 20 years, and people say, well, you know, bees didn't collapse 20 years ago. But we're looking at it as a saturation point. And, you know, if you look back to your early science classes, they drop a little bit of red dye in a glass of water, and you could drop after drop after drop, and it wouldn't go red. And all of a sudden, that final drop makes everything go red because that's the saturation point. Well, we feel that the world, with the rollout of the wireless technology, has actually reached the saturation point and is now becoming a worldwide epidemic.
So it's not only affecting their homing instincts, but also their immune systems. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. What it does, it actually affects every living cell on right down to the cellular level. When I don't want to get too scientifically complex about it, but the waves that carry the information for cell phones or other types of wireless communication, there's the information-carrying radio wave that's carried on the carrier wave, and it's pulsed in a certain fashion that every living cell reacts to. They don't know what it is. There's vibrational proteins on the cell wall, on the cell membrane, and because we don't know what it is, it's like a fight or flight. The cell membrane reacts in a cautionary fashion, and what that does is it shuts down transport channels. It negates intercellular communication, and the whole organism from the cellular level to the tissue, to the organ, to the organism.
Right, it affects the whole body of the bee. Now, of course, there was some studies that were done in Germany that were quite well publicized, but maybe we can get a little bit, dig into that and give us some details of what actually happened there with these exposed cordless cells by the beehives. Maybe
right.
You can just explain that.
This is just one example of the wireless technology and the effect. There's three scientists at Landau University in Germany. They had a control group and an experimental group. And in some of the hives, they had a decked cordless phone base station underneath the hives. And in the others, they didn't. And they took these 25 bees from each of these hives up to, I think it was 800 meters away, and released them. Now, of the 25 bees that escaped, that they let go, in one hive, 16 returned, and another 17 returned in 28 and 32 minutes. But in the exposed hive, only 6 bees went back to one hive, and no bees went back to the other in well over half an hour. those hives also had a lot less cells constructed for their larvae.
Okay. So these cordless, was it a phone that was put underneath the hives?
Well, it's the base station for the decked phone. So the base stations constantly transmit. And people say, well, it wasn't a cell phone, but they work on the same principle. They send packages of information, pulses, that are regular pulses. And those regular pulses, our cell membranes react to them.
So it's the same, it's equivalent of walking around with a remote phone but not having it on.
Yeah, the base stations for these the portable phones in your home radiate all the time. I mean, I see people having them beside their bed on a night table. Well, they're just being subject to radiation all night.
Right. So now, of course, conventional science always wants to have a solution to everything. What do they foresee here? I mean,
well, there is a solution available, Carl. Dr. George Carlo, who ran the wireless industry's 6-year, $28 million research program, and I work together, and we've been working on this solution, and what it is, it's been developed by the U.S., the Israeli, and the Russian military a number of years back. It's called noise field technology. And what it does is it superimposes a random signal on the pulsed information-carrying radio waves such that the cell membrane ignores it, doesn't recognize it, doesn't see it as harmful, and doesn't react to it. So therefore, if you put a noise field technology on transmitters, they would be benign to the planet, and that's what we're promoting. But you know, the awkward part there is you're mentioning. I think John was mentioning Health Canada earlier on. I mean, they're still in denial mode that there's any health effects.
That this is happening, I mean, your writings and of course your association, the Save Wireless Initiative and Clean Energy Foundation. Maybe you can give us your web pages here, and you're presenting possible solutions to this chronic disappearance of the bees.
Yes, what we're trying to do is get beekeepers on site. You know, when I don't know if there's more frightening words than hearing, you know, we're from the government and we're here to help you. and that's really where it is right now. They're reacting by saying, well, it's pesticide and we have to change that. It's the varroa mite, which was in the news years back, and we have to, you know, get different kind of pesticides. They're also talking about genetically modified crops, climate change, viruses, but none of these things are universally dispersed. But yet, all of those things are harmful. So, you know, this is really gives us the opportunity to examine what we're doing. And in effect, we're using factory farm techniques for bees.
I was just going to ask about that. This must be a big factor in also the declining health of the bees, so that they could suddenly collapse. I mean, that seems very plausible.
Well, that's right. What they do is they load these colonies up in great huge flatbed trucks, and they take them around to pollinate all these different crops when the time is right. So they're trucked all over North America. So that's very stressful, on bees. They're doing it more in North America than they are in Europe, but nonetheless, that's also a stressor. So you add that to the information carrying radio waves that naturally break down the immune system, because it does, as I say, interferes with intercellular communication and intracellular communication. So it's a recipe for disaster. But, we keep trying to fix nature, and it's got a several billion year head start on us.
Well, we have to decide whether nature is friendly or unhelpful or a mother to us or an enemy. And it seems that it's science these days has taken that route, that it's an enemy to be conquered rather than a mother to be prized and loved.
I know. I just say to people all the time when they're talking about the various science, for and against various issues, is just follow the money.
So have you found out what has been the position with organic people who grow organic bees?
Well, organics are not having the big collapse problem, but there's probably a number of reasons for that. A lot of organics are out in the country where they've got organic crops over and above the bees. And also, just, as everybody that's listening to this program, I'm sure is aware that if you're eating organically, you're going to have a stronger immune system and it's better for you. So they would be healthier. But still, nonetheless, there are less bees. I know I walk my dog at Everett Crowley Park here in Vancouver, and it's a 100-acre urban wilderness, the old Vancouver City dump. And there's a lot of, cherry trees and apple trees and different things that have blossomed that I've been looking at over the past few years and saying, where are the bees? The blackberry bushes there used to be just moving. You'd see them moving. There'd be so many bees on them, and now you could count the bees.
I have one last question,
yep.
Because our next guest already online. Excuse me. But, one has these little items which one can purchase, which you put on your cell phone. Are they effective in dispersing these harmful electromagnetic smog, as you once called it?
There's a lot of snake oil out there, for sure, because you can't see the radiation. If you have something that's got a magnetic resonance energy technology on it, and you can check on the website for MRET, M-R-E-T, those are effective, but most of the things on the market aren't.
Well, thank you very much, Milt Bowling. Maybe in just closing, you could give us your web page. People want to hear more, and we're certainly going to have you on our show again.
Well, thanks, Carl. Sure, if they just go to safewireless.org, O-R-G, or they could go to cleanenergy.com, cleanenergycanada.com, sorry.
Thank you, Milt Bowling.
Thank you, Carl. Yeah.
And we're listening to Animal Voices here on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. We'll be right back with Professor of Geography Brian Klinkenberg and Project Coordinator of the efauna.bc.ca.
Dr. Klinkenberg is now on the line, and John has just stated, he is the coordinator of a project designed to provide a free, comprehensive electronic atlas of the wildlife of British Columbia. Welcome to the Animal Voices show, Brian.
Thank you.
Now, this sounds like an enormous project, getting all the animals of British Columbia into an atlas. And I'm interested to know how this project got started. Can you tell us?
Yeah. I guess, one sort of way that it came about is that we've been involved in another project on the plants of BC called the eFlora.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And it was much easier developing that project because there were comprehensive resources on the plants of BC, but our thoughts were that while there were books out there, it was very difficult sometimes to find information on the internet that explained about the biodiversity of the province.
Mm-hmm.
And so our idea was, why not take some of this information that's available sometimes in texts, you know, experts' books in a sense, in the heads of experts, and take some of that information and make it available so that anybody anywhere within the province can find out about the flora and in particular, this case, the fauna of British Columbia.
Now, the flora, then, is pretty well completed for the time being, but there'll always be upgrades, I guess, isn't it? Updates, rather, for either of these atlases.
Oh, yeah. These are never-ending projects, in particular for plants, but also for animals. A lot of genetic work is being done, which is restructuring our view of the world and where different species fit relative to each other. So on one hand, there's all of the new science that's being discovered. On the other hand, there is all of the, in a sense, the exploration that's still ongoing. I just remember reading a news article about finding new species of lichens in the interior forests of British Columbia. So even in a province, you know, people might think is as well known as British Columbia, they're still finding new species in the province.
I think we have the widest variety, don't we, of animals in any of the provinces, or am I wrong?
Yeah, because we go from the oceans up to the mountaintops.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And so for, you know, Alberta, of course, you know, it's lacking.
You're lacking, of course.
The oceans, and so, you know, British Columbia has a remarkable biodiversity.
Yeah. Now, I imagine there are other people working with you on the project, are there? I know you've got the expert information, and that must come from wide sources, but do you have a team that works together?
Yeah, well, in terms of actual work, it's myself and my wife, Rose Klinkerberg. She does a ton of contributions in here, mm-hmm. and we have programmers who we've hired through Service Canada, and we search for funding. Some places like Mountain Equipment Co-op have provided support for us to hire programmers.
Good.
And so the information is coming from a wide variety of sources, and that's one of the sort of not really problems, but one of the complexities of eFauna BC
right.
is that once you start looking at the fauna of BC, it's just, I mean, there are just so many different groups of animals out there.
Ah, yes. Yeah, and I know Rose personally. I've known her for many years. She's a botanist, isn't she? So she was probably instrumental in, especially in the flora atlas.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, both of these projects, in a sense, came about from our life outside, in a sense, and looking around, and you say, oh, you know, as a previous talker was, you know, about bees, for example, and you say, oh, what's that? You know,
mm-hmm. yeah.
How can we find out about, you know, the bees that we see, or the spiders, or, you know, the little shrew or vole that you see running about?
Yeah.
How do you find out about those things? And we discovered that it's very difficult.
Yes,
do that.
But it's much, much easier, isn't it, using the electronic atlas. I know I've tried it myself, and I'm no expert on the computer by any means, but I know I could find things, so that I'm sure that anybody with skills would find it very quick.
And
it's such a wide range, all from the insects right up to the largest animals, so that it's so readily at hand. I think it's great. Now, will you give us an overview of the atlas, please? I know it's divided into three sections, isn't it? And just so people know what they'd be getting into if they wanted to use it.
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, there are three sort of main components to eFlora, and we have what we call the introductory pages, or these are just sort of static web pages that you can access. And what we've asked are the experts of these different groups. So for the spiders of British Columbia, there's an expert, Rob Bennett, who's one of the more knowledgeable persons in the province about spiders. And so we've asked him to prepare a description of spiders in BC. And similarly, for groups such as the mollusks in the Royal BC Museum, who are important contributors to this project, they have several experts. And so Robert Forsyth, he's actually talking about land snails and slugs, but for Phil Lambert, for example, from the Museum of Royal Museum, he's providing information on sea stars and sea cucumbers. So we have a variety of experts who have freely given us, in a sense, you know, their knowledge about different species groups within the province. And so that's the introductory pages, which provides an overview of different species groups. We then have, for several of the groups, what are atlas pages. And atlas pages are the means by which we try to provide up-to-date information on different species. So we have atlas pages on the butterflies and on the dragonflies, on shrews and voles and bats. So extracting information from existing publications, putting it into an electronic database, and then enabling the public to search for a species in our to our search pages and pull up an atlas page which contains, for most of the groups, a map showing where you might expect to find it. We're hoping to have photographs for every species, and we have, if we have access to it, diagrams, illustrations of the species. Plus, in a sense, one of the more interesting parts is we have access to an interactive map that enables you to zoom in and look a bit more about the distribution of species and maybe how they relate to climate, weather, to geology, to other factors that might influence species distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have links on the page to other atlases or projects. So for the mammals, we have links over to the Smithsonian Institute. They have pages that describe mammals, and so we've linked directly to their pages, and they're excited that, you know, we link up to their information. So it's building upon the collaborative nature of the web.
It's wonderful, yes.
And the final third project here, part, is the Wildlife Gallery. So we have, there's just wonderful photographers about the province, and many of them have embraced e-fauna and submit just wonderful pictures of birds and of insects, of all the different species that are around the province. So as time goes on, we hope to have basically a gallery showing you pictures of every species that we can identify within the province.
Yeah. There are advantages that on the web that you are on the electronic device that you couldn't get in books. It would be impossible. From my quick look at the information, it seemed to me you can kind of combine, can't you, sort of overlay the location and the animals and the climate. Isn't there a way of interconnecting those?
Yeah, that's what we do in the interactive map. So if you go to an atlas page, for many of the groups, we'll have access to collection records. So these are going to the various museums around Canada, so the Royal BC Museum, but also the National Museum in Ottawa. They provided us information about where they've seen species. And then we've obtained information from other sources, which talks about the precipitation, the climate, so various factors like that that you can then overlay on with the species distributions information, so obtain insight into the, the biodiversity. And you know, for example, everybody knows probably about a Soyuz, and it's when you look on our map of temperature, it's a much hotter area. And there's many different kinds of insects that are associated with that climate that you won't find elsewhere in the province.
I see. Now, the website has been up for a while, hasn't it? And I'm just wondering, who are the main users of this? Are there any groups that you've noticed particularly? Age groups?
Well, it's a variety of groups. We try to aim the content at both experts by providing things like scientific names and nomenclature and links to genetic databases. But we also want to make sure that the public can access it by placing the information in a form that they can understand. So we've had high school groups. We know that there are community college classes that are using it.
Good. Yeah.
So it's, and we get queries from the public all the time about they find an insect or something in their backyard. Could we tell them a bit about it?
I see. Yeah, that's great. Now, is UBC one of the sponsors of the project?
Yeah. UBC, through the Department of Geography, they support the all the servers are sitting in the department here, and we have some technical staff that provide assistance. So, mm-hmm. you know, they within the department, we house it. One of the other big sources, as I mentioned, is the Royal BC Museum. They provided, they've granted us permission to take the content of many of their older publications and scan it from the text and put it into a database and put it online. Oh, yeah. So they've been fantastic. And we have other departments, of course, in UBC, the in botany, biology department, zoology.
Boy, you have lots of cooperators, don't you?
Yeah, it's
good to hear. Now, and you've been living on grants and donations, I guess, to get the fund or get the atlas moving ahead. And are you still looking for help in that regard?
It's, as you said, this is a never-ending publication. It's as we say, it's a living book, mm-hmm. and so there's always fine-tuning to be made to the information as you discover things. So, you know, one of the things we're just working on now with, we have volunteer help. One of the volunteers is going through the butterfly pages and identifying the species of plants that butterflies depend upon.
Oh.
And so we're going to develop links between eflora, so the plants on eflora, that says, so if somebody looks up a plant, there'll be a box that says, oh, these butterflies mm-hmm. depend upon this plant. And conversely, within the butterfly pages,
yes.
they'll be mm-hmm. able to go and see, okay, if I'm looking for this butterfly and it's associated with these plants, where are those plants known from? So, mm-hmm. you know, those kind of linkages are ongoing as we learn more about the biodiversity of the province. But we have, if you go to the homepage of eFauna BC, down at the bottom of the page is a notion of how to make a donation, because
uh-huh.
it is a very much volunteer donation driven project.
Is there a tax exemption that would attract people to giving to that particular
yeah,
project?
Well, because the money is going to UBC.
Ah, yes, I see.
So, so I don't get the money. The money goes to uh-huh. a fund that we established through the University of British Columbia.
Sure.
So if you make a donation, it's through to UBC, and then UBC issues a tax receipt.
Mm-hmm. Good to know. Now, give us the website, will you? I guess we're just about running out of our time.
Okay. It's very easy. It's just eFauna, so efauna.bc.ca.
Good.
efauna.bc.ca, and the companion site is eflora, which is eflora.bc.ca.
Good. Now, just a sec, Brian. John has a question for you.
Sure. Well, I'm on your photo gallery page here, and I see spectacular pictures of butterflies here, for example. Have you got pictures? And you must have quite a staff of or people of, that you draw from of photographers who are doing this kind of work. Do they get paid? And, I mean, it's quite a project to have all these people hunt all these little these little creatures down and so
yeah.
on.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things about eFauna and eFauna is that there are people who are dedicated to these things, to understanding and taking pictures of butterflies, of spiders, of plants around the province. So we're just extremely lucky that we have a whole group of volunteers. Nobody is paid to do anything except for our programmers. So all of this work is entirely volunteer-driven, and they upload the pictures, and then we have experts review them to ensure that, you know, if they call it a snowy owl, it's a snowy owl, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So everything, we try to make it as correct as possible, but we entirely depend upon volunteers and donations by people and corporations.
So the people who identify all these animals and insects, they all volunteer their services as well.
Yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the one thing about having a publication on the internet is that it provides a memory. And so one of the mm-hmm. things that we've noticed is that a lot of the experts who are providing information are retired professors, for example. Don McPhail, freshwater fish at BC, he's providing us his list, and he's retired. A lot of the people are retired, and their information, in a sense, could get lost.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're providing is a means for all of their knowledge that they've gained over these years to be put in the public domain and accessible to everybody, so that we can build upon that. And that's one of the great benefits of E4 and E-Fauna, is that it's a process of putting in your memories and allowing them to be accessed by the public.
The internet is a great resource and a great sort of symbol of what humanity is really like.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask one more quick question, and that's about, you were talking about the money involved, and I would think that this information could be used by commercial users also, people into forestry or agriculture or other industries. Is there a way of keeping track of that and getting any revenue out of that source to pay for the project?
That would be something, but... it's very difficult, of course, if you allow the public to access information. The public can be anybody, whether it's a consultant or a high school student. So we have no way of sort of restricting access, but we don't really want to. We want it to be available to everybody. What we hope to happen, and this sort of has happened, in that different groups find the information so useful that they recognize that they should contribute to it. And so BC Hydro has, you know, we said you have people who go there who need to know this information. If you can contribute some funds to us, then that would be very helpful. So they provided a bit of funding to put these pages together.
Yes, I should think that would be a good idea, just to lean on the people a little bit who have some financial interest in the, in the atlas, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this has been great, Brian, and I want to thank you for the your presence on our show, and congratulations. I think it's a marvelous project that you've undertaken. So I'll say goodbye to you now, and we'll get on with the rest of the show.
Okay, well, thank you. And if people have any comments, please do send them in. We always appreciate hearing from people.
Do you want to just give them one last time the website?
Okay, so it's eFauna, E-F-A-U-N-A, .bc.ca.
Good. Thank you so
Google
much.
Google search, they'll find it too.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Good.
Thanks, Marge.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Dr. Brian Klinkenberg, who is a geographer at UBC and coordinator of a project called eFauna BC, and certainly one worth looking up on your computer.
Yeah, and up next is Gaia Gardens and Herbal Dispensary and Clinic with Robert McCandles, and we're going to talk about Project Natural Health Products, and is Canada Health Canada set to dismantle the natural health product industry? We'll be right back.
Red-winged blackbird down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird, red-winged blackbird down my road. He'll be there beside the river when winter finally breaks its bones. He'll be king among the rushes, he'll be master of his home. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. But I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Safe as Moses in the rushes, makes his home on the river wide. Every time I hear him singing, makes me feel like spring inside. But I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. But I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Singing his heart out, he'll be telling stories too. Where he went to winter last year, how he's going back there too. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Thought
I heard a red-winged blackbird, red-winged blackbird down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road.
You're tuned in to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM. My name is John Pranger. And while we're waiting for our guest, I think Carl has something to say about Mother's Day.
Yes, Mother's Day. Well, of course, all animals have mothers too. One sees it how affectionate they are to their offspring and how they protect them in every way. So in this Mother's Day, we could recognize the mothers of all the animals we see, of all the dogs and cats we know, of all the chickens and pigs and rabbits. Well, I was reminded of a story of when I was in New Zealand, and I was on this little tour bus going off to one of the caves there, and then it was about six of us in the tour bus, and then this fellow saw a rabbit running across the road, and so he swerved and wanted to kill this rabbit. So I was sitting fairly in front, and I said, what are you doing? He says, well, they're a pest here. So I said, rabbits have families too, you know.
Yeah, but those families aren't important to.
Right. Like that. So we recognize all the our kindred species of which we are, we're part of the animal kingdom as well. So at this Mother's Day, May your celebration be animal friendly. Mm-hmm. So John, there's been quite a bit of news in the animals in news in the papers lately.
I love that picture that you had, Carl, about the chickens playing football.
Yes,
that was beautiful. Well,
there was a picture in the Thursday, May the 10th, Vancouver Sun, and was a pair of roosters and this lady who kept them as pets, and how these roosters were playing with a soccer ball. Well, I don't know where the goals were. It doesn't say it in the end, but they were certainly having fun. And when you see the roosters playing with the ball.
Well, that's a goal for sure. He's kicking
it. He certainly does seem to have his foot up all ready to kick that ball. Wonderful. I think the guest is on the line now.
Yes, Robert McCandless is a herbalist at Gaia Gardens Herbal Dispensary and Clinic. And he's going to talk to us about some of the tricks and what do you call them? Blue greenies or something that Health Canada is up to. A relatively new government directorate focused on natural health products is about to develop regulations that will have very serious consequences on the type and availability of natural health products. And Common Ground is hosting a public meeting to discuss this issue on Tuesday, May 29th at the Chai Tea House, which is at 3243 West Broadway. That's upstairs. You can call Jamie at 604-733-2215 to reserve a place for yourself, because seating is limited. And this meeting, it follows meetings in Ottawa on May the 1st and the HPFB Cost Recovery Initiative's May 15th deadline, so there will be lots to discuss. Robert McCandless, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And what is this HPFB Cost Recovery Initiative?
Well, this comes from the Auditor General's program, who's Canada's head accountant, and they're looking for an increase in their funding, I think, of about $41 million a year coming from licensing of health products.
Uh-huh.
That probably includes the drug industry and homeopathics and herbal medicine and vitamins and so on.
Well, the drug industry can afford it, I suppose. Is that also true of natural products manufacturers and retailers?
Well, certainly not small manufacturers like us. They're asking us for about $500,000 a year.
Good Lord.
And we don't make anywhere near that sort of money. So if these things go through, our shop will be out of business by Christmas, I would say.
Well, and you're a fairly large pharmacy.
Well, we're little in the scale of drug companies.
Of course, yes. Yeah. What, but you're not a manufacturer yourself, are you?
Well, yes, we are. We make products.
Oh,
we have 500 different products that we actually make from raw materials, and we make creams and tinctures and herbal teas and all that sort of stuff, and we sell actually worldwide on a small scale.
And what's provoked this move? Something you say, the cost recovery. Okay, that's a fine thing.
Well, they're saying that the costs to them are excessive and they have to make up the funds.
Even though they insisted on regulating the industry.
Right? Well, about 12 years ago, when David Dingwall was Minister of Health, he was going to put everybody out of business. And there was a huge letter-writing campaign, the biggest letter-writing campaign in Canadian history.
Wow.
And Dingwall was thrown out.
Wow.
And then when Alan Rock came in, he was a real cooperative man. I have a lot of respect for him. And we had we worked with him for about 10 years developing what they said were their three principles, which means access to natural health products, quality of natural health products, and safety of natural health products. So, mm-hmm. you know, this we were in Ottawa probably every 2 or 3 months working with them on this. And, of course, our costs went up. We had to hire extra staff, and there's way more paperwork now, but we've absorbed those costs.
When you say we, you're talking about...
I'm talking about Gaia Garden
okay.
in particular. Mm-hmm. But we thought, well, okay, if this is what the public wants, that's fine. Let's work with it. Some people said we were nuts to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We thought, well, we'd rather work with them than let them do it to us.
Some people thought it would be a trap, right?
Some people thought it would be a trap, definitely.
Yeah. And so what did it turn out to be? So carry on your story.
Well, so far it's been okay. Our prices have gone up. However, we are in business. We are functioning. We sell all over the place, and we're getting more and more business steadily all the time.
Mm-hmm.
However, this is going to kill us.
And that's because the public demands more and more of your services as they grow less and less enamored of the medical profession and its predation.
Exactly. We provide an alternative, and some people want that.
A lot of people, more and more, a growing number of people.
Educated people, yes.
And the more that we want it, the more resistance the government seems to put up. And now this attack.
Well, I guess you could call it an attack.
The government spends all kinds of money. It doesn't need to recover costs for many things.
I don't think so. They've got all of our products on file. It's just a matter of keeping them on file. Mm-hmm. And yet every product we sell, they want $920 a year from us. Just to let us sell what we're selling. That's where the $500,000 comes in.
How do they rationalize that? What kind of accounting is that? I don't understand. What is the cost to them? And regulation
to
is part of the government.
File, I don't know. I think the licensing is it's a fundraising deal.
Yeah. Now the we know, and many people know, that some 10,000 to 20,000 Canadians are killed by pharmaceutical drugs every year. 100,000 to 200,000 in the United States. 1.5 million hospitalized.
Yes.
And you reduce, 100,000 hospitalized Canadians. Pharmaceutical drugs. How many people are actually damaged or killed by natural health products?
The average is zero a year.
Zero.
Mm-hmm. I've had one complaint in 25 years as a herbalist.
So, really, the concern of HPB ought to be to regulate very, very, very cautiously and carefully the drug industry rather than herbal medicines, which have proven their worth over centuries of use.
Yes, I think any sensible pharmacist would agree with that. You've got to have you got to really look carefully at the safety factors there with drugs.
And this safety factor in herbs, how is that being monitored? I mean, you only need to have the clinical monitoring. You don't need to do, for example, elaborate animal tests, which cost $100,000 a shot and take 3 years and are inconclusive after all.
No, certainly not. These herbs have been used for thousands of years. They're well-researched in Britain, Germany. It's extensively researched. You go on the Internet and you'll be buried in information. So it isn't anything new.
And the
safety factors are approximately, I would say 99% of what we sell is safer than coffee. If coffee came on the market now as a new herb, it would not be allowed by the FDA because there's too many side effects.
And so neither would aspirin.
Yes, true.
And that's been used for 100 years and more.
Yes.
But it causes birth deformities in rats and other animals. So you could easily raise the alarm.
For children.
Yeah. And Comfrey was yanked off the market not so long ago, you remember, because of an animal experiment where they injected a very strong tincture of of the herb into the directly into the liver of a rat that got cancer, and the alarm went out, and the product was pulled off the shelves in record time. And you see how efficient they are then.
Well, yes. That there was also involved was two babies in Australia. Their moms were drinking Comfrey tea during the pregnancy. The babies had some liver problems. It was assumed that maybe the liver problems were due to the Comfrey, which is a speculation. Mm-hmm. However, we do not use Comfrey with pregnant women now for that reason, because of that maybe.
One clinical piece of information.
Yes.
Unbelievable. And yet Vioxx killed how many people before they yanked it off the market?
I don't know.
It's in the 150,000, I believe.
I see.
Of injuries and death.
Yes.
So there's this colossal Goliath, and we, the David
it's,
with the slingshot, how are we going to defeat this monster?
Drugs. The world's number one industry is munitions and weapons.
Yes, and probably owned by the same people.
Well,
I know. The Rockefeller name comes up often.
That's quite possible.
And you know John Rockefeller, who was, he pretty much controlled 80% of the drug industry.
Yes.
He had a homeopathic physician all his life and attributed his longevity and his good health to the fact that he never took any drugs which he was pushing on other people.
Yes.
Imagine that.
Yes.
Yeah, and all made out of oil, which is mm-hmm. a very lucrative substance. And
he used to sell petroleum off of a wagon as a cure for constipation.
Yes.
That was his original.
When the doctors complained, they put in beta-carotene and said that solved the problem, and I believe they were still selling it not long ago as, I forget what it was. Yeah, probably a cure for constipation. But they were selling it off the backs of the wagon with as a possible cancer cure already, the father of John Dee. And, of course, then he knew the infinite gullibility of the American public, and you could sell them the Brooklyn Bridge, no problem. Mm-hmm. And they've been selling them toxic drugs and agriculture for years, and yet the doctors, too, are so misled that they consider that only their methods are scientific, and the homeopaths and the naturopaths and the herbalists are quacks.
Well, you know, where that changed in North America was in 1930 during the Depression, because the government had no money to fund the medical schools, so all of them were going to go bankrupt. But the Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation offered these schools money if they would put pharmacology at the top of their curriculum and drop all mention of herbology and natural medicine.
I see.
So many of the schools that survived, most of them were actually became drug schools. And you can't blame the doctors, because that's what they're taught in medical school, is that herbs don't work, or they're dangerous, or they're all quackery, and the drugs are the answer.
It's amazing that
you can't blame the doctors, because that's what they're taught.
Well, that's right, and they get about an hour of nutrition in their four-year courses.
Well, it's getting a little better, and there are a lot of good doctors out there who realize that nutrition and sunshine and fresh air and all these things are very, very important, and they are promoting them.
Oh, yes, and there is a revolution within the profession itself, but
exactly.
It's very difficult for doctors, and you have to admire the ones that do rebel, because they're up against a mighty force. Who
precisely. It's a big economic machine.
So what is your tactic, and what are we going to do?
We're putting a gravestone in our window today saying herbal medicine 4000 BC, 2007 AD. It's just an attention-gathering device to get people to either sign our petition that we have in the shop or to contact the... you can contact the Health Food Associates, the Canadian Health Food Association, on their website, and you can get the link where you can write a little letter to the government, which is supposed to be by May 15th. They've given us a week to respond. Anyway, that's chfa.ca. If you go to their title page, you'll just you'll see the link.
Yeah, and that's, what is it? I got it up here. Where are we? CHFA.
CHFA.ca, I believe.
.ca, that's right.
Yeah.
Now, there's also in Common Ground, is it in Common Ground? Yeah, this issue of Common Ground, there's a sample letter that the Canadian Health Food Association has published here, so you could probably copy that, or I guess it's just telling you the website.
Well, you know what really works?
Background information as
well. What works 12 years ago with the 100,000 letters is a personal letter.
Sure.
You could say, I'm a consumer, I like to have access to these kind of health products, herbs or whatever, because I think it's preventative medicine. Mm-hmm. And please don't take away my right to access these things at a reasonable price.
Yeah.
Because if we were to raise our prices, I mean, if we put our doubled or tripled our prices, I guess we could keep up with this deal. But I think we'd lose an enormous amount of customers that way, and I think it would just kill us. Yeah. So
the government is looking for all ways to cut costs, and the staggering bill for pharma products is bankrupting the system. So that I don't know what the rise is every day. It's like $250,000 every
day. That's the biggest part of the cost of our health system is drugs, I believe. Yeah.
So
Hospitalization, I guess, as well.
Yeah. So these our MLAs are absolutely convinced, I suppose, that that is, you know, the system is all we got. The little bit of nastiness that comes from people like me and you, you know, out on the fringes. Well, we don't count much anyway. So
I
just
going to
carry on tinkering with the system.
You've got all of the Shoppers Drug Mart and everybody else are selling herbs now. All the pharmacists are studying herbology. Mm-hmm. So I think it's coming in, and I don't mind that. I don't mind it.
Okay, but you're saying that
I just want to exist too.
Yeah, right. And it's going to spill the market quite a bit because it's going to, you know, it's going to unlevel the playing field.
Well,
pharmacists the heavy sluggers
used to be herbalists. If you go back into the 1920s, all pharmacists knew a lot about herbs, and the doctors as well. So they're just going back to what they used to do. So this is fine. But don't kill us little guys at the same time as you're selling your products.
Yeah, right. But yeah, and you started the movement. You're part of the grassroots movement. You did all the legwork. You deserve to be kept in business and not be taken over by these giants who suddenly take an interest because of some monetary
I would like
gain.
To think so. And most of our customers would probably agree with that.
And I think that your quality control systems are far better, too, than theirs because they kill an awful lot of people and say that they don't. And it's the same with the herbs. I doubt that they would care very much for organic standards or any of these things. They're just out to make a buck.
It's interesting that right now in the States there's a push, and I don't know where it's coming from, but there is a push to bovine growth hormone to be added to all the milk, getting rid of the organic and getting rid of the genetically modified labeling. There's a big push for that, and they're asking for responses on that issue on, guess what, May 30th.
Yeah. No time at all.
So I don't know. I don't know much about that story, but it looks like it's a parallel to what's happening in the States that we've got here.
I think that's to do with harmonizing ourselves
exactly.
With the United States and with Mexico, right?
Yeah. Let's erase
it's a race
border.
To the
who,
bottom.
Who needs a Canadian flag anyway?
Yeah, right.
You know?
A race to the bottom and herd us all into this one world pen. There you go. Be happy.
Yes.
Well, thanks a lot, Robert, and we'll follow this story, and maybe we'll have you back maybe next week. I don't know.
Wonderful.
All right.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Robert McCandles of Gaia Garden Herbal Dispensary and Clinic. They have a website, too. It's called GaiaGarden.ca, if you want to visit that. It's a beautiful website. And as I said, all sorts of products there dispensed with good clinical evidence for their efficacy. So that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Thanks very much for listening. My name is John Pranger, and this has been Animal Voices. Stay tuned now for EcoShark with Alex Smith.